So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here. And who'd have thunk it? It is our 50th episode. And I think you're going to love it. The feature interview this week is with an explorer. She's traveled the world with David Attenborough. And she touches on this trend that there is at the moment for micro adventures. This idea that you should sometimes get up off the sofa and challenge yourself. So I think you're going to find it inspiring. You may not have yet set off for your annual summer holiday, and this interview just might make you think twice about whether you should book that all-inclusive in Ibiza for the same time next year, or whether instead you should go zip-wiring with polar bears or something. Also, finally this week, Ollie Peart has reached the deadline on his challenges, so you'll hear the final update on that. And the Foxhole this week is a feedback special, so you'll hear how or not Alex has helped Man fans in the bedroom across our last 50 episodes. So it's a fun show this week, and whilst I'm in a celebratory mood on this significant anniversary, you'll forgive me if I knock out a few Manbassadors. Why should I just do it at the end of the show? It's my show. I can do what I want. My name's in the title. Ollie Modern. Sarah in Norfolk says, Ollie, I've enjoyed your podcast since I don't know when, but being a woman of a certain age, 59, yes, really, I always felt I was looking through the door to the theatre and that I didn't really belong. However, your interviews are getting better and better. Thank you, Sarah. And I guess I really need to pay for my seat now. Sarah, you are most welcome. And please do take a seat in the dress circle. Your PayPal donation wasn't quite Royal Box level. And you are now, I'm proud to say, our Manbassador for Norfolk. Amy in Minnesota as well says, Ollie, you warm the cockles of this Minnesotan's heart. It's very cold here. I love hearing about what's going on across the pond, and I'm happy to have started buying you a monthly beer. Thank you, Amy. You are the living exemplar of my business model. If not already taken, I'd love to grab the mantle of Manbassador of Minnesota. Keep up the good work. It will take my mind off our horrible president and soon-to-be non-existent health insurance. Amy, it's a pleasure. You are now officially Manbassador for Minnesota. And finally, Meredith in Georgia, USA, has written in to say, Ollie, I've been listening to your show from the very first episode. I got my husband into it. I wrote you an iTunes review during season one, and we are now both monthly beer money donors for the show. I'm fairly sure you don't currently have a Manbassador for the US state of Georgia, so I was wondering if my husband, Josh, and I could be joint Manbassadors. Thank you for your time considering this silly request. It's not silly, Meredith. Nothing could be more deeply solemn than being appointed to a senior ambassadorial role on behalf of your state. But yeah, I now proudly anoint you, Meredith and Josh, joint Manbassadors for the state of Georgia, USA. Congratulations. Thank you, everyone. This is going to be our last show until season 6 begins at the end of October. So savor it. In this week's show, you will learn how to get hold of some snail slime, you'll learn what consentical porn is, and you'll learn why sleeping in a snow hole in Scotland is fun. No, honestly, it's fun. Let's go! On this week's Modern Man.
We are all actually hardwired to want to be in situations that test us, even if we don't think we do.
Escaping your predestined life and climbing your personal Everest. How to live adventurously.
Turkish delight and then some afternoon delight.
and Alex Fox revisits her greatest hits in a Foxhole Feedback special. But first, it's time for all the trends you need to know about. It's the Zeitgeist with the man whom, at the end of season 3, was a carnivore. We had our rap party in Honest Burger. At the end of season 4, was a vegetarian. And now, as we speak to you at the end of season 5, is a fully fledged vegan. It's Ollie Pitt.
I'm not fully fledged.
Elaborate.
I don't eat cheese and dairy stuff when I'm at home, but when I'm out and about, it's too difficult. So I'll have cheese and dairy.
What are the trends we should be knowing about this week?
Uplit.
Okay.
So The Guardian are citing Uplit as the new trend in books. It's a type of novel or nonfiction book that's really optimistic rather than feel good. So the difference is it provides you with everyday heroicism or human connection and love rather than, say, romance.
What makes this a trend then?
People are buying more of them. An author called Rowan Coleman, he says that because we're living in really dark times, right, people want a bit of an outlet. They want to see that humans aren't that bad after all. They're actually quite nice.
I see. So it's basically saying suppress that part of your brain that knows that people in the free world of their own volition will vote for Brexit and Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
And tell yourself
block that
out. Actually, of their own free volition, people are inherently good.
Yes, exactly. Okay. People are nice, aren't they?
Well, are good. I sort of see that. But the thing is, we did have a recession a decade ago, and I'm pretty sure that coincided with every book being about people's incredibly miserable childhood. So the two things don't necessarily correlate, do they? The world can be falling apart, and people can still really enjoy reading about children getting beaten up. What's that about?
And actually, it ties in with what I was saying. Do you remember I said that the last series of I'm a Celebrity...
Yeah.
I really liked it because everybody was really nice to each other.
Because everyone just got along.
Yeah, so I spotted this ages ago. People want to see people being nice to one another. That's the bigger trend, I think. It's not just within books. It's within everything. Why would you want to watch people being horrible to one another?
So if people do want an uplift, what books should they be buying?
Well, there's some new releases coming out in September. Jamie Thurston's Kindness, The Little Things That Matter. But the one I think I'm going to be going for is... Diversify in October by June Sarpong.
Sarpong's written an uplit.
She has. And according to the blurb, it's going to be a fierce, empowering call to arms.
How can it be fierce and uplifting? I suppose it can.
Yeah, you can. Lions are, aren't they?
Yeah, lions, it depends on your perspective, doesn't it? If you're about to get eaten.
Still be impressed I've seen one.
What other trends should we be looking at this week, Ollie?
Male cosmetic counters.
I mean, I haven't seen it in Debenhams.
No, it's not a thing. And it's not going to be for another 5 to 7 years.
Wow, okay, you've really taken the brief with this slot and run with it.
Vismay Sharma is the UK boss of L'Oreal. They're basically saying that men's cosmetic counters are going to become a reality within 5 to 7 years' time. You go in, and it'll be much the same way as it is for female counters. And you go, I've got a little blemish here. Have you got any stuff? And they'll go, yeah, here's the stuff.
No, that's not how it works. That's not how the female counters work.
It's not,
I've got a blemish. Can you cover it up? It's like, oh, let's have a day out. Let's play around. Let's make each other up. Oh, you look great. Let's spend 2 hours, trying out different products we never actually buy. That's fun. For a lot of women. I think it's never going to be like that for men. So I completely see where this trend is coming from because male beauty products now are mainstream, aren't they? And most men listening to this probably have tried a moisturiser at least.
Yeah, but this is different. This is male makeup.
Yes, exactly. I don't see men who wear makeup turning it into a day out in the way that at the moment women do in department stores.
I don't know. Do women turn it into a day out?
Yes, really.
Really?
I know it's weird.
No, that is... That's
the thing.
Won't happen.
It's like a spa day. It's like a cheap spa day.
What Sharma says, though, he's saying that the reason he thinks it's going to be a trend is because, he describes the generation that are coming up as the selfie generation. They really want to make sure that they look their best in their photos online. And I know you can get like digital beautifying apps and those kinds of things, but this is like one step further. And the question that they're asking isn't if men decide to start adopting makeup. It's when and how. Mm. So they're trying to work out if it's going to be really big, bold colours like Bowie or if it's going to be like these subtle sort of, pastely type tones and all that kind of stuff. So they're adamant this is going to be a thing.
Right. Let's talk about your trends challenge. We set you up this series to become a true trends insider. You've been updating us on a weekly basis with your success and or otherwise in getting through this particular list. Let's deal with the matters outstanding first. Mm-hmm. I'm almost anxious to ask, are you now Twitter verified?
No.
Okay, what's happened?
I felt like I needed to really push this because they
haven't... Oh, you realised 10 weeks in?
Well, no, because they haven't got in touch with me after my last application.
Yeah.
So I thought, what's the best way to get in touch with Twitter? I've sent them a letter.
A posted letter?
I posted it, special delivery, tracked and all that stuff. Cost me £6 to post an A4 bit of paper, handwritten letter.
So you're getting in touch with a social media company whose raison d'etre is saying things digitally in few characters.
Yeah.
And you're sending them a long letter in the post.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense.
Why did you think that would be the best way to get in touch?
It makes perfect sense, Ollie.
Does it?
Think how many times I get bombarded on a daily basis with nonsense online. They're trying to figure out ways that they can filter it without actually using real humans. I have forced them to use a human to read that letter.
Okay.
There's no way. You should see the handwriting. It's awful. No machine is ever going to read that.
You didn't write it in green ink, did you?
They might screw it up and throw it in the bin. The point is,
I
know that someone's going to read it.
Complicated things even further. You've made it even harder for them to say yes or no, haven't
you? I don't think it's complicated things at all. If I worked at Twitter, I'd read that and go, do you know what? They've really tried.
But that's not the criterion, is it? To be verified that they've tried.
Yeah, but I fulfil the criteria.
You do fulfil the criteria. You just made it hard for yourself. This whole series, you've made it hard for them to say yes.
I fulfil it. And
stop fucking around. You've just sent them a letter in the post.
I reckon
what are
I'm
they going to do with it? They're going to have to refer it up to someone who won't know what to do.
No, they've got me in some kind of like limbo land. I'm pending.
Yes.
And it's an algorithm that decides it. So I've forced them to get a human to go, well, he does fulfill the criteria. Let's just do it.
Right. So they haven't read it. And as far as you know, they haven't responded to it.
No.
Have you succeeded in getting tickets to the London transfer of Hamilton? I mean, it sounded very unlikely from last week's conversation.
No, but do you know what? I got so close.
What, closer than Janine?
Yeah, much closer than Janine. So a few people got in touch after hearing the Janine story because a few people know Janine. And they said, not surprised she was like that, but actually she's not too bad. She's known for not suffering fools, so I'm a fool. But that meant that people got in touch because they knew her. And a chap called Ollie Southgate got in touch. And he lives in Canada. British guy lives in Canada. And he has a ticket for Hamilton. And he was like, well, look, why don't I give you my ticket? It's in December. I was like, well, that's great. Let's do that.
Wow.
So we went through the process trying to source.
You know, we didn't specify VIP tickets or anything. We just specified getting a ticket.
We went through the process and...
What do you mean the process?
Well, because you... To transfer the ticket, because it's got his name on it.
Oh, I see.
And you can't. You can't transfer tickets. It's fraud, apparently. So can't do it.
What?
Yeah.
But what if he just doesn't want the ticket anymore? Does he have to go back into a lottery pool or something?
Well, no, he just loses his money. And that's what I'm saying about the theatre industry. That's why I'm going to boycott it.
Okay, and the one other outstanding matter was the parliamentary ghost train. I could not give a shit, but Matt is insistent that you try. Well, have you tried?
No, I don't give a shit either.
Right. Right, but the rest of the list, you've done pretty well. You've held a Nando's black card.
Chicken checks too.
You've sort of become a Freemason.
Freemason's Arms.
You met one.
Mm-hmm.
You've sat at a chef's table.
Yeah, a cook's kitchen in her own home.
You've joined an elite dating app.
Hello, ladies.
You've acquired AAA access to a festival.
Cheers, Jim Taylor. John McClure.
And you tried the latest cult skincare treatment or product.
Second latest, because look down here.
Oh, you've got another one.
Yeah, you remember I told you about that snail stuff?
Yeah, you couldn't get hold of it.
I could get hold of it. It was on Amazon Prime. I didn't know.
Oh.
Well, no, because I was looking in all the like the exclusive shops and stuff, and I thought, I actually haven't checked Amazon.
How much is it?
£15.
Okay.
£30 in the posh shops. So if you want this stuff, Amazon.
What's it called?
Multifunction Formula All-in-One Snail Repair Cream. And it's by a brand called Mizon, who are based in South Korea. And they love sticking snails in stuff.
With your vegan status, how do you feel about products made from snails?
I can't use it because I'm vegan.
How convenient.
Apparently, the way that they get it, they have this like purpose-built glass, and the snails sort of crawl over it, and all the juice like leaks out, and then they stick it in this gunky, horrible. Put your finger in it.
I mean, do you think it's bullshit, or do you think there's, because it is a trend? I've read about this now as well since you mentioned it. Snail repair cream.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they have recently discovered that there's this incredible repairing quality for human skin in snail gunk, or is this just a fad? And I'm about to smear something on my face that is just inherently hilarious.
Well, rather than thinking, so two people got in touch about this.
Rather than thinking,
Amy and Melanie got in touch.
It's a new name for the sloth.
Well, no, because I thought I'm vegan, so I can't try it. Yeah. So Melanie offered to try it for me because she's got some. She lives in Finland.
She's a man fan.
Uh-huh. And she was going to send it to me originally, but it would have just taken ages. So I said, well, how about you try it out and then let me know how you get on, and then I'll tell everyone in the show.
Okay, what did Man Fan Melanie from Finland make of it?
Well, initially she was like, I can't believe I'm putting this stuff on my face.
Yeah.
But 4 days later she says that she loves it.
Oh, really?
And she has noticed an improvement in her skin tone.
Okay, I'm putting it on my face now. It's quite cold.
A snail's known for being cold?
I think I preferred the intense tightening serum that we tried last week.
There is definitely something
there's a gunky quality.
Gunky.
It's a bit Alex Fox, isn't it?
It does feel quite sexual, yeah, in its nature. Oh, God.
Okay, so I've put it on and my face feels moistened.
The idea behind it is that snail slime is like bacteria and UV radiation and all that kind of stuff. It's got everything in there. Apparently, the snails have all these qualities. So they thought, well, let's milk them, stick it in a pot and sell it. And they're doing well. 15 quid a jar.
And on the metaphor of milking a snail, we almost end this season of The Zeitgeist. But Ollie, I'm afraid we did add an extra challenge to your list of challenges last week.
Yes.
You said, I mean, you pretty much volunteered to do this, that it would be easy to set us up with a cryptocurrency donation platform for our beer money.
Mm.
How did it go?
Turns out doing it, you can do it, but it is quite complicated.
How many hours have you spent doing this?
Genuinely, probably about an hour and a half.
Okay, see, time's money. Time's money.
Yeah, that's.
Are you going to earn an hour and a half out of this?
Oh, definitely not.
No.
No. I'm expensive.
This is why cryptocurrency is a problem at the moment.
But yeah, I got to the stage of being able to create this button. It's just really...
It's not as easy as it should be.
No, and it should be really easy because people would just use it.
Well, you say people would use it. I say no nerds would use it. And that's why I was resistant to it. But we do have some nerds listening.
Well, nerds already use it. That's the thing.
Yeah, and I'm happy to take money in any which way.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard unit of beer money that people can donate to the show if they want to support this show is £3.47.
Yeah.
You can do that now just on our website using PayPal or your credit card. Just go to modernman.co.uk and click beer money.
Mm-hmm.
I will try to embed your weird form.
Yep.
So if there's then a link on that which says, and you can also pay us with cryptocurrency, then well done. Your link has been successful. And if I can't, then sorry, nerds, you can't.
Exactly.
Just pay us using PayPal as well. You probably had one of those for 20 years. There was nothing wrong with it, was there? No, just pay us with that.
Or post cash.
And with that, Ollie, we have reached the end of this season of Zeitgeists. How was it for you? We've made you work a little bit harder.
Yeah, it was expensive in both time and money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so satisfying, wasn't it? Getting to talk to people like Janine and...
Oh, yeah, that was memorable.
Going on trains that weren't quite the right train you were supposed to be on.
Hey, the train was good. Highlight for me was the festival.
Yes, VIP access to a festival.
That was really good.
There you are. You cling on to that memory. Ollie, I'm sure you'd be up for this. If people have a challenge they'd like you to try next season.
Yes, go on.
Then they can go to the feedback form on our website.
I didn't know this.
And suggest it.
Great.
Well, it's inevitable, isn't it? You've got through your list of 10.
But it's in
what
their
are we
hands
do with you
now,
next
is it?
Time?
Rather than yours.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. Listeners, it's in your hands. What would you like Ollie Pitt to do next season? He sounds so up for it. He's the most reluctant.
You not see how tired I am. I'm exhausted.
Have some snail cream.
I'm not touching that.
Now, what is the most adventurous thing you've ever done? For me, it was probably, completely and advisedly, swimming across Lake Malawi wearing only swimming trunks. I had no support boat, I had no supplies, and I was swimming to an island that was, it turned out, much further away than it first appeared. But I was 18, and I was on my gap year, and honestly, what's the point of having one of those, unless you nearly kill yourself? But since then, I haven't really been involved in anything very adventurous at all. I'm quite happy, frankly, getting my fill, watching other people suffer on the island with Bear Grylls. But world record-holding explorer Belinda Kirk, she's built differently. She's walked across Nicaragua, she's searched for camels in China's desert of death, and she's led dozens of expeditions around the world. But even for her, it all started with a gap year trip to Kenya.
I think it's pretty normal to be an 18-year-old and you've been through the systems, haven't you? You either go to school and university or you go into school and then an apprenticeship or a traineeship or something like that. We're all put into systems, and this was something that I decided completely for myself. My parents were actually pretty much against it. I had a call. It was kind of a calling. Sounds a bit wanky, actually. I just had a.
But if it's true, there's no better word for it, is there?
Maybe.
An instinct.
An instinct. Yeah, I just had to do it. I just knew I had to go. And I had complied. I had been compliant. I had done well at school. I'd worked hard. I hadn't got in trouble. I'd been too compliant, if you ask me. Now, looking back, I think being compliant is not always a good thing. But I had towed the line, and it was time for me to do something I wanted to do before I got back on the merry-go-round and got back into the whole university thing. So off I went, and I felt like I was me for the first time. I felt like I was really good at stuff as well.
Practical stuff.
practical stuff, being in nature, being in environments where you're tested and you have to make decisions quickly, being in situations where you're not sure what's going to happen next and it's actually quite exciting.
Okay, so give us an example.
Well, I had two pretty bad experiences, which would probably have sent most people home. So I went up to Nairobi, and the first night I got there, and sort of one of the first nights away from having been in part of a team, I met these local ladies and hang out with these local ladies for the evening. After several bars, we ended up in a brothel, and these local ladies were prostitutes. Mm. And I didn't know how the hell I was going to get out, actually.
Had they intentionally been grooming you?
I think probably, because there's a big white there is a white slave trade. And I was 18, green as hell, didn't know anything, long blonde hair. And with travelling on my own, I could have just disappeared that night so easily. Anyway, this big Australian dude came up to me, and there was various people trying to talk to me, and I just was ignoring them. And then this guy just said, "Are you okay?" And it was the way he said it, and I was just like, "No!" I started like going, "Oh my God, help me, get me out of here." And he got all of his oil worker friends, and they literally like lifted me up and walked out the door with me. And the girls were screaming, and there was a massive fight, and... Wow. It just kicked off. And at that point, that's where I knew actually it was definitely, you know, you kind of know when you just can't leave somewhere. You walk in and then you just like, I'm in trouble now. And I think that would have sent most people back home. But for me, it was like, it just made me more stubborn. It's funny. I speak to a lot of adventurers, and the really honest ones often say it's not the people that have supported them through the years that are their biggest strength. It's actually often the people who've tried to stop them or told them that they can't do something. And there was something about giving up at that stage. It was something about if I just stopped and decided to go home after that and got scared, or decided to do things easier in an easier way, I wouldn't have been doing myself a service. So I think those are make and break times when those things happen. And then literally within days, I was on a bus, and very sadly, somebody died on the bus next to me.
And how? I think,
well, they got on, this bus was supposed to take 18 hours. It took 2 days in the end. The guy got on halfway through and sat in the seat next to me, and he was obviously very ill. I gave him some water and stuff, but I mean, I didn't really, I had a smattering of Swahili at that point. And just, yeah, when I woke up at the next sort of, you know, we got into the city and I woke up, there was a kanga, a piece of material over his head. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, this is going to happen to me if I get ill. People are just going to not be able to communicate with me and just leave me. But those two things happened, and it kind of made me sort of want to fight harder to stay there. And I was like, no, I'm going to make the most of this. And what I'm not going to do is give up.
Was there an element of enjoying the fear of that as well? I mean, those are both good stories, even though, you know, if they'd have ended worse for you, they'd be terrible stories.
I think, obviously, the guy dying on the bus, there's no positive way to kind of come out of that. Apart from, I suppose, maybe just...
It's an adventure, is what I'm getting at. You know, you were talking about how your life at home sounded kind of pedestrian and you were a bit trapped by it. And then you go out there, and the whole point of being there is you're confronted by unusual things. Two extraordinary things happen to you. That's exciting.
I think we are all actually hardwired to want to be in situations that test us, even if we don't think we do. And we all have our own levels of tolerance and levels that we can deal with before sort of stress that promotes growth becomes stress that promotes traumatic disorder kind of later. So the whole kidnap scenario was something that I probably dined out. I can't really remember now. I bet I dined out on it for ages afterwards. You know, it was the whole idea that I was going into something that wasn't planned, that wasn't decided for me by someone else. I think what a lot of people suffer from is that they feel that their life is just kind of predestined almost. It's kind of decided by someone else, and you get into a rut and then you can't get back, you can't get out of it. There's no escape, especially once you get a mortgage and have family and you know, things like that. It's so definitely living adventurously is hugely important to me, but I think it's actually important to everyone. When I came back from that first trip, I was a changed person. At that time, I saw it as travel and adventure, and you know, expeditions. What it really is, it's about adventure, because you can find adventure here in this country. You can find adventure everywhere. It's about living adventurously. All the way through university, I did expeditions. So I joined an expedition in both the summers and got my kind of built up my skills, assistant leading. I led my own expedition of the first expedition that I led myself when I was 21.
And what kind of skills are they? Because, I mean, people listening to this, we've seen Bear Grylls saying drink your own piss. I mean, is it that sort of thing?
I wouldn't recommend drinking your own piss at any time ever. I don't think Bear's ever done that either, to be fair to him. The skills are planning, logistics, routines, it's understanding environments. So I've sort of specialised in jungle and desert. So that's what I'm really good at.
And what are the big challenges of the desert? I'm guessing hydration.
Exactly. In a desert, everything's about water. All the logistics, everything depends on where you can get resupplied with water, essentially, where you can find natural supplies, or whether you actually have to go and get it or be supplied. Navigation is extremely hard in a jungle, so that is one thing that often determines the logistics of a jungle expedition. If you're somewhere like the Amazon, you've got loads of rivers, you're all good. But you are bound, if you're trying to cross a particular area and you want to leave the rivers, then you have to find other means of navigating. And also the rivers move, especially in flooded forests. They can be in a completely different place each year. So the maps are meaningless. The kind of claustrophobia of jungles is hard for a lot of people, especially climbers, I found. People who are used to being in big mountains and big vistas with big skies find jungles terrible. They tend to not like them. I love them because they're full of life. The fact that they're full of life is a big challenge and is a huge part of the planning involved. So, you know, you've got all the creepy crawlies and snakes and things like that. And you just have to be very good with your routines and your discipline, really, as to how you operate in a jungle, because people always think that, you know, you'll get bitten by snakes. That's one of your biggest risks. Actually, it's all kind of insects just bothering you, more likely. Things like malaria. There are some really great parasites in jungles that can be debilitating, though, at times.
Now, exploring in Tanzania does appeal to me. I can see the exotic appeal of that. It's a beautiful place. The climate is generally quite nice. And, you know, yes, there's a risk of things like malaria, but you can take jabs before you go. But when you talk about extreme conditions, that's something that, if I'm honest, just does not appeal to me. I get sort of hot and sweaty and irritable if I have to search under the stairs for too long to find my trainers. The idea that I would volunteer to spend a day, you know, with snow and grit raining down on my face, or in conditions that are extremely hot or extremely cold, with pain on my back carrying stuff, I just know I would actually hate that. Am I wrong, or am I right to know that I'm not the right person to do that kind of thing?
Have you ever done that?
No.
Well, then how can you possibly know?
Because in the same way that I've never done skydiving, but I know that I'd chip myself on the plane.
And... Oh, you'd love that as well. I think everyone has their Everest, and it might be Snowdon or it might be Everest, so everyone has their limits. We, as human beings, we evolved, and our bodies and our psyche evolved to be under both environmental pressure. You know, it's actually good for us. There's loads of studies that show that getting hot or getting cold, going through those sorts of changes in environment, is extremely good for us. It's good for our long-term health. And also, there's loads of studies about psychologically, it's very good for us to be tested. So I challenge you, actually, and I think you should go and try something like that before you say you wouldn't ever take to it.
Well, okay, so what is the right kind of thing to try to dabble with? Because Everest is not a good one to start with, I'm guessing. What should someone like me, who, you know, likes a walk, you know, likes a pretty vista, but doesn't really want to confront the idea of severe discomfort, what's a good starting expedition?
I think the word expedition might be throwing us off here. A starting adventure, mm-hmm. You can do all sorts of things right here in Britain. It doesn't have to cost you a lot of money, mm-hmm. or time, or put yourself in major danger or anything.
Great. Where should I go?
There's loads of cool things in London, like walking over the O2, or whitewater rafting, or abseiling down the Olympic Park, that big statue. Mm-hmm. There's loads of cool things like that. I think there's a lot of benefit in getting out into nature. So have you ever tried wild swimming, for example?
No, that I'd probably be all right with.
It's about getting out of your comfort zone. So you don't have to go and beast yourself and like be miserable. But you have to, I think it's good to push yourself, try new experiences. It's so extremely good for us to do that. So in London, say, you can go to the Serpentine and swim in the early morning mist, mm-hmm. You know, get up in the dark, get down there before anyone else, go in as the first, you know, as soon as they open. Mm. And it's a spiritual experience, and it will be testing, and it'll be cold because the sun won't be out. And you could even build up through the summer and this autumn, and you could start swimming in the winters.
I mean, I can see that would be a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also full of feces and frog spawn, presumably. I mean, in a way, isn't technology a good thing? We've got swimming pools now. Just go for a swim there.
Well, the Serpentine isn't. It's a swimming club. So you can literally go outdoor swimming there. And it's the great thing about it is it's clean. It's kind of hard to put into words unless you've tried it. But the difference is it's clinical. It's a kind of man-made environment. It's all a bit safe. It's all a bit known. You go swimming in a lake or a river, and you can start at the Serpentine or Hampstead Ponds. You can basically start somewhere where it's official wild outdoor swimming, and therefore there's a lifeguard, there's all sorts of water quality checks, you know. It's kind of a safe start for wild swimming. And you can lie on your back in the water and look up at the sky, and you can maybe see a swan or some ducks or... It's because it's not man-made, and it's because it's not regulated and rule-driven, and you can be surprised by it. And we, as humans, we're supposed to live a bit more like that. We're not supposed to live in boxes, looking at screens, knowing what we're going to do next day, the next hour. It's exciting, basically. There you go. Maybe it's just exciting.
So, your life, like everyone else's, does involve a lot of living in boxes, looking at screens, and working out what you can do the next
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely.
How do you inject mini adventures into your day to day?
Like so many things in life, you just make time for it. We all say we're going to do stuff and then we don't. We're all going to get fitter, we're all going to be slimmer, we're all going to be cleverer, we're all going to read more, we're all going to be, you know, watch the news more, whatever it is. We're all going to better ourselves every year, aren't we? And then we don't. We don't go to the gym, we don't do whatever we said we were going to do. Well, the great thing about going and having adventures is it's not only good for us, but it's also fun. Mm. So it's a lot easier to stick to. So my sort of top tips would probably be tell some of your, like find some mates that want to do stuff as well, because it's a lot easier. Once you've said to your friends, yeah, we're going to go camping that weekend, or we're going to go and swim in the Serpentine before we go to work on Wednesday, let's do that.
And it's in the diary.
And it's in the diary, and they're going to come with you. And it's, or even if they won't come with you, you just tell everyone you're going to do it. Mm. Then you've got the embarrassment factor of not getting on and doing it. And once you do it, you'll love it and you'll want to do more.
There's also, and this is totally not the reason you should be doing it, I'm sure, but there's the validation factor now, isn't there, with social media? I mean, a lot of people go to extreme places so they can take a selfie and post it up on Instagram. But I suppose in a way that's a good thing if it's got them up the hill.
Yeah, it's a bit sad, but it is. It's maybe it's just human nature. Oh, I don't know. Or maybe social media is making us more narcissistic. I think there's suggestions that it is. There's even, apparently, I've heard that there's even a bunch of people who simply go to places in order to get pictures of themselves there.
Yeah.
They kind of get out of the car park and get a snap. And, yeah. You know, they don't really go and experience it. It strikes me as being a bit sad and a bit of completely not what it's about. But as you say, maybe anything to help people break the inertia is a good thing.
And what about you professionally? At what point did you decide this could be a job, not a hobby, not a thing that you do at the weekends to fulfill yourself on the side of whatever else you do, but that you could be a professional explorer?
Initially, I paid for them. I saved up the money. I went on my expeditions. I paid to be an assistant leader on expeditions, so I paid, you know, part of the price sort of thing to be an assistant. I built up my experience, and then eventually people started paying for my insurance and my flights and free, you know, free expedition place if I helped lead. And then eventually I started getting paid. But it was never really a conscious decision of like, this is going to be my career. It was more that I just have to get adventuring. I just have to get onto these adventures. Whether I pay for it or whether I get paid doesn't really matter, as long as I can keep going. So I still do expeditions for free if I think they're brilliant, and, you know, and I pay for expeditions, I get paid for other expeditions. It's as long as it all works out. I'm never going to be wealthy in money terms, but I think I'm wealthy in experience terms.
And in terms of shepherding around TV crews, what shows have you worked on that we might have heard of? Who have you ended up supervising on an expedition?
So I ended up running remote film crews all over the world with Ray Mears, Bear Grylls, Chris Ryan and David Attenborough. And then I did stuff in Britain, like Coast, the Coast series. I don't know if you've ever come across that. That series, Coast, actually got me to start looking at Britain in the way that I'd looked at the rest of the world from all my career. I'd always gone abroad for adventure. I'd always gone abroad for feeling alive. I was always living between expeditions. But then I was like, wow, Britain's amazing. It's got a load more than I ever realised. Just this year, I've been swimming with seals down in Cornwall. I've been sleeping in a snow hole up in Scotland.
That sounds really grim.
No, it's wicked. You'd love it.
Really?
You would actually love it.
Even Edinburgh in August is a bit cold for me.
There's this thing in adventure called type 2 fun. So type 1 fun is fun at the time, fun afterwards. Type 2 fun is not fun at the time, but it is fun afterwards. And type 3 fun is not fun at any time.
Right.
So there's a lot of type 2 fun in adventure, definitely.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff that makes you grow, and that's the stuff that makes you realise what you can do and what you can get through. And yeah, sleeping in a snow hole can sometimes be type 2. But there's amazing camaraderie that comes with that, you know. You make such great friends doing adventures because you come through adversity together.
And what about short-haul trips, you know, from Britain to Europe? So people listening to this, they've got a full-time job. They're not going to go to Tanzania for the weekend, but they could go to Italy. They could go to France. They could go to Denmark. Give us some ideas for things people can do to go and explore this summer.
So there's loads of lovely hiking. You know, you've got the Dolomites. You've got the kind of ancient forests of kind of Belarusia and around there, you know, this that still have bison and wolf and stuff. You can go kayaking down the Ardèche Valley in France. There's so many things. You can go water skiing and water wakeboarding and stuff off Saint-Tropez.
What are the places that have surprised you the most?
The really big surprise I've had is discovering Britain. I spent 15 years of my career and my life running away from Britain to find excitement. And then in the last 5 years, I've been finding excitement right here.
I mean, what's the riskiest thing looking back on it now? You actually think, I can't believe I did that.
Probably rowing around Britain. That was much more dangerous than any of us had ever realised it was going to be.
Because?
Because we have the busiest shipping lanes in the world. We have the strongest conflicting currents. And we didn't actually know what we were doing. All of us were kind of aware, I think, that we were aware. Because just before we left, I was like, it had sunk in that we weren't ready for this. I tried to find a sailor to join our team and I never found that sailor. So in our team, there was lots of clever, competent people, but we didn't have the skills to go out to sea for what turned out to be 2 months, non-stop, unsupported, in a little 24-foot boat with no engine and no sail, just paddles, just oars. And we nearly died several times on that trip. And when you're in charge and you're the skipper, you don't want to be in that situation. So I had to be really clear to everyone. So we nearly got run down by a couple of boats a couple of times. Nearly got swept onto the rocks. It was terrifying at times. And I won't do it again. Mostly because I've done it now. So why do it again? But nearly killing yourself is not fun. This whole idea of pushing yourself and going outside of your boundaries and going outside of your comfort zone is important. But by doing that a lot, you take calculated risks. And that was the first time in years that I had miscalculated. And miscalculated it a bit, definitely.
Belinda Kirk. And if she's inspired you to make your life a little more adventurous, why not take a look at her non-profit Explorers Club? It's called Explorers Connect, and if you become a member of that, you'll find out about events, challenges, and talks. Check it out at explorersconnect.com. Alex Fox is up next, so brace yourself for a Foxhole Feedback special after this.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The moment is here. It is time for our Foxhole Feedback Special. Are you excited, Alex Fox?
I'm permanently excited when I'm around you, Ollie.
It's the Foxhole
finale.
It is. Well, yeah, no, but not forever. Just for this season.
Just for our 50th episode.
But for our 50th episode, we thought we'd look back. We've never done this before, because we often talk about subjects on the show, sexual subjects. Some of them are quite niche. Some of them are really mainstream. But then we don't return to the same topic again, because it's kind of like, oh, well, we've done our threesomes bit. We've done our bit about polyamory. We've done our bit about small penises. And I wanted to know whether this has affected you out there and what your reaction was to Alex's advice over the 2 years now of this podcast. So, Alex, are you ready to hear how people have responded to the last 50 Foxholes?
I am salivating at the opportunity to revisit people's niches, Ollie.
Okay, well, here is our first piece of feedback.
I'm quite nervous.
I hope
I've helped people.
Don't be.
I hope no one's written in and gone, it's god-awful and now my wang has dropped off and it's all your fault, Fox.
Don't be nervous. I'm a gentle and considerate podcaster. This email's come in from Anonymous, who says, you answered my question, Alex, in Season 3, Episode 2. Season 3, Episode 2, what was the subject? It's fine.
No,
I wouldn't expect you to really remember that. It was about pleasing my boyfriend who had a smoking fetish.
Oh,
that
yes.
one, yeah. Alex suggested that I try an e-cigar in the bedroom. I do remember
cigar,
that.
E-cigar!
And I'm happy to say that this has been greatly received.
Yes!
Although it's not as good as the real thing. She's put that in quotation marks, so I think that's from the horse's mouth there. It tastes much better, it gives out a lot of smoke, it doesn't make me nauseous, and it really excites my man. On special occasions, we'll bust out a real cigar, but I now take things a lot slower so I can enjoy it and there's no pressure of sex right after.
I remember now, she wants to indulge that fetish without actually damaging her lungs or giving herself potential health problems in the future.
The curtain smell.
Did you know that there's actually dating sites particularly for people who like to vape these days?
Oh, really?
Like,
so not smoking fetish particularly.
It's more people who are enthusiastic about vaping. Mm. So they're brought together by their shared interest.
And since we spoke about smoking during sex, have you discovered anything else about this?
Well, I've got a couple of dating ideas for this couple, in fact. If they like the idea of being teased in public, they could go to one of those shisha cafes and then she could smoke in front of him publicly and kind of tantalise and tease him that way. And then they can go home and get it on in a cloud of smoke.
Any venue where foreplay can involve Turkish delight is a winner for me.
Turkish delight and then some afternoon delight.
The HH guy has written into us as
him
well.
Him from Steps?
No. HH, this is the bloke we spoke to the other week with the micro penis.
Oh, hypergonadotropic hypergonadism.
Exactly, yes.
Hypergonadism. My God, that is, it's quite a tongue twister.
Trips off the tongue. He says, thank you, Alex, for the very kind advice. It was really nice just to be able to tell someone without fear of being laughed at. And you have given me some new ideas for what to do next, but you also confirmed that some of the thoughts that I had been having were probably on the right track. So thanks again. No promises, but I may drop you a line if and when I make any progress.
Oh, please do. I have to admit, I haven't heard from so many people with this particular situation. So it's always great when we get these letters where I have the opportunity to learn something and expand my repertoire of knowledge, as well as hopefully helping people. I discovered something really interesting about people with HH, actually. Mm-hmm. Some of them also have the symptom that they have an inability to smell.
Why would those two things be linked?
I'm not entirely sure, but
that's
it's intriguing,
bizarre.
Isn't it?
So undeveloped genitals and correlates with inability to smell.
Yeah. It doesn't work the other way, though. If somebody can't smell, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not packing much in their
undeveloped
pants.
Undeveloped genitals. Understood, yeah. James has been in touch to say, Alex, I wanted to drop you a quick note to say thank you for your section on polyamory. About 4 years ago, I entered into a poly relationship with two other guys, and it was the best thing I've ever done. My two boyfriends have been together for 15 years, but me entering into their relationship was very organic and not something any of us were particularly aiming for. I've never been happier, and I can't imagine my life without them.
Well, that is completely luscious.
That's a success story.
Yeah, a huge success story with lots of sucking in the success by the sounds of things as well. Have you heard of a woman called Rosie Wilby?
I have not.
She is a stand-up comedian who's just published a book called Is Monogamy Dead? That's all about her personal experiences and adventures with trying things like polyamory. It brings up some really interesting questions.
Yeah, fair to say it wasn't plain sailing for her.
It wasn't plain sailing, but then again, I think she rather enjoyed being at sea.
And actually, James continues in his email to say the thing that's different in his relationship with these two chaps compared to the kind of relationships we were discussing is that he is duogamous. So he and his two boyfriends are only physically and romantically involved with each other and nobody else. So they still draw the line somewhere, which is interesting.
Yeah, they're a self-contained unit. So even though they're having a relationship with more than one person, they won't be sleeping or having romantic attachments with additional people there.
He says, one of my boyfriends also has an 18-year-old daughter who's absolutely amazing and titled our iMessage conversation Modern Family. And ultimately, we are just like any other family, except there's more of us. Quite often when people hear about polyamory, they immediately think, slut. But Alex, you did a really, really great job in quashing some of the stigma that comes along with the concept. In the same way he says that we've been fighting for years for homosexuality to become normalised and accepted, it would be amazing if someday the idea of relationships with more than one person became a bit more normal and a bit less shocking.
I hope so too. And I think it's important that we discuss these things, not only so that such people can gain acceptance, but also so that they can have equal rights in terms of things like legality and access to pensions or access to healthcare, that kind of thing.
Well, he actually does go on to say that he read about a three-way marriage in Colombia the other
day. Yeah. This was three guys called Manuel Bermudez, I hope my pronunciation is right here, Victor Hugo Prada, what a name, and Alejandro Rodriguez. Those three men married each other, but actually originally there was a fourth man in their polyamorous relationship called Alex, who really sadly died from stomach cancer a few years ago. It was his death that actually prompted them to look into marrying because they had extreme problems accessing the money that he'd left for them, getting access to things like his belongings, which obviously had great sentimental value to them. They really campaigned to get married so there would be no problems for them in the future. But by doing so, they've also set a really encouraging precedent for other people who are in that situation.
Here's another piece of feedback. This one is about when we were talking about partners with different libidos.
Oh, okay. This comes up a lot.
And yes, this person who's remained anonymous said, I would like to recommend the book Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski.
Oh, it's a famous one.
Is
and it? A brilliant one. Yeah, she's excellent.
He says it really helped me to understand my wife and she, having eventually read it, to understand herself.
I really do recommend that if you've got some time on your hands, take a look at this book. Like I say, it's a classic. It's a lot of people recommend this and for good reason. If you go on her website, though, you can actually download a load of free PDFs and they're really good. One of which involves the idea of mapping your partner's stress. We've talked before about how stress and anxiety and depression can really be huge barriers to sexual understanding and sexual wellness. She suggests that you write a list of 10 things that wind your partner up and 10 things that help to chill them out. And that might sound a bit formulaic, but actually bearing that in mind and having it at the forefront of your head all the time can really, really help for you to cater to your partner's needs and be more aware of them. She also talks about intergluteal penetration, basically lubing up the peach seam between someone's butt cheeks and then either running your penis in between them without actually going into the anus, just up and down the butt crack, or using a sex toy or your hands to stimulate that particular area. And it's an underrated part of the body, I think, the butt crack.
It may be. I mean, you've jumped very quickly there from here's a book to read if you've got a differing sex drive with your partner to would you like to stimulate the gluteal muscles with your penis?
I
imagine over the course of a book, that makes more sense.
I have special skills. What can I say? My segues are unprecedented.
Sometimes a lot of your advice, Alex, I think as well, just comes down to communication, doesn't it? Having an open and honest dialogue with your partner, saying what you want or what the problem is, often outside of the bedroom.
Yeah.
And Rebecca's been in touch in response to a discussion. You might remember this was last season, actually, and we were talking about someone being punched in the face. It was a man, a young chap, being punched in the face by his girlfriend 10 or 20 years ago, and only just now looking back on it and realising that in a way that was, you know, he was the victim of physical violence during sex.
Yeah, I really vividly remember that letter. He was sort of treating it as though it was a bit of a joke and laughing about it, which is a common way of framing a traumatic situation. But as we read out the mail, we were both quite shocked at what had gone on there.
And also you as well talked personally about your experiences of something similar when you were younger. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca's reacted to that. She says, I just wanted to thank you, Alex, for your open and honest discussion about your experience of violence during an intimate moment. When I was 16, I was punched so hard in the face during sex, I was left with a bruised face and bloody lip. To this day, 15 years later, I still feel sick to think about it. But she says, I reacted in much the same way as you, brushing it under the carpet, move on. And that really is something that's resonated with people, isn't it? Because actually, that is probably how most people react to something that's a one-off. If you're not part of an abusive relationship, they'd just rather not talk about it.
It's hugely common. And then it can, in later life, add to the sense of shame and regret and fear surrounding a traumatic situation, because you're then angry with yourself for not reacting in the way that, as an older adult, you think you ought to have done. Yeah. So again, as a victim, you can continue to blame yourself for a situation that really wasn't your fault at all.
No, exactly. But the good news is she says she's taken that bad experience in her life and has used it to ultimately shape her sex life in a good way. She says, since then, I've always taken a lead role in sexual experiences. I think this is my need to be in control and avoid anything like that happening again, but I now know what I like and what my boundaries are. And then she says, what almost could be a catchphrase for the show, really, sex is much better when all involved can openly discuss what they want before and throughout any activities.
It's really brilliant to hear that she's now in a positive place with this. If that ever changes, I would absolutely encourage her to go and speak to a specialist about it. I think we should all bear in mind that sometimes the way that we feel about the past, it can ebb and flow. You can be okay with something one day and then not another day for whatever reason. You might have another experience that triggers thoughts. Something might happen that causes you to recontextualise a past experience. All of that is completely normal and healthy, and there are loads of help out there for you should you feel that that's something that's good for you. In fact, I should probably say it's brilliant that people write into me, but I'm really aware that I can't always answer questions straight away. If you feel that you need to speak to somebody immediately, there's actually a brilliant, really thorough list of all sorts of helplines for lots of different scenarios. If you head to supportline.org.uk, in addition to giving links for people who've been through an experience themselves, it also offers suggestions of help for people like partners or families of people who've experienced sexual violence or trauma. So there's loads and loads of links there, and many of them have hotlines that you can call immediately, any time of the day or night.
Someone else at the lighter end of the spectrum who's been in touch to say that they've benefited from some communication with their partner as a result of your advice was Mr. Yiff, the guy who liked his furry erotic art. If you don't remember this, listeners, it's worth going back through our archive. It's basically people who get aroused by looking at Scooby-Doo. He says that he did speak to his partner about it.
Uh-huh.
She's not interested in joining him, but she fully understands that he wants to look at it on his own. So that's good, isn't it?
Excellent. So he's free to jack off to his pictures of anthropomorphized animals. And she's probably, well, God knows what she's looking at.
She's probably reading a good book.
You know that I have a bit of a soft spot, or I should say a hard spot, for unusual types of pornography. I find this completely fascinating. There's a few I've come across, so to speak, lately, Ollie. Let me tell you about consentical porn.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds like something Brian Cox would have invented.
Well, there's all sorts of people.
Cox, yes.
Well, you may have heard of hentai, which is the sort of Japanese cartoon pornography. Mm-hmm. And then a subset of that is called, let me see if I'm going to say this right, Shokuju Gukan, which is tentacle rape. It's the sea
tentacle rape.
Yeah, it's sea monsters and mythological imagined creatures with all sorts of tentacles coming out with suckers on and everything. This theme of being raped by a hideous creature is of quite a strong flavour that tends to run through this genre of pornography. For some people, they find that although they like the drawings of the creatures, they don't like that non-consensual element, or ostensibly non-consensual element. So there are certain groups on the internet, unsurprisingly one of them's on Reddit, but they're all sort of all over the place, where fans of tentacle porn are producing their own consentical tentacle porn, called consenticles, where they draw pictures of women who are exceedingly happy to be done up the foof by a piece of squid.
Well, that is certainly a niche that people can explore in the next 2 months or so whilst we're off air. If you have a question of sex for Alex for season 6, and, you know, fingers crossed, 7, 8, and 9, we hope to do at least another 50 of these, then all the details can be found on our website, modernmanwith2ns.co.uk. Just click on feedback. And Alex, we should take this moment, should we not, to give an extra big, special, horny, lubed thank you to mycondom.com.
Yes, I am going to smear lubricant all the way up past my elbow and even right up to my shoulder in order to slither my arm around theirs and hug them with all of my might, because they are wonderful.
They are great. They're, if you're going to have sex, go to mycondom.com first. They sponsor the Foxhole. And that really does mean, folks, that we wouldn't be able to bring this section to you without their patronage. And also, they provide some excellent prophylactics.
They do. One type of condom that you can get from them is called Manix, which is the sort of...
James Dean Bradfield's expanded into safe sex?
No, thankfully not. I can't imagine a more depressing kind of coupling than that. No, it's actually the French version of Mates.
So is it any different to the Mates you can buy in Britain?
You can get different varieties to slide over your baguette.
Oh, can you? Mm-hmm. What do they have? Camembert flavour?
If you request it, Ollie, yeah, someone will create it.
mycondom.com is the very definition of build it and they will come.
And remember, you can get an unbelievable 15% off all of your purchases at mycondom.com, even when we're off air, by using our special discount code, which is FOXHOLE.
I would have said that link was cheesy, but it was appropriately so. Alex, thank you for the last 50 episodes.
They've been e-damn good.
Have you? Oh, God.
A huge thank you to everyone who's listening and everyone who's sent in their questions. Don't forget as well, I'm always really keen to hear your stories, your feedback, your thoughts about sex. Anything you've got to say, send it my way.
And with that, we have reached the end of this season of The Modern Man. Thank you for supporting the show. Financially through your beer money, pragmatically through your feedback, and evangelically through your iTunes reviews. We are doing this for you, man fans. Thanks. Our theme is by Django Django. It's from their eponymous debut album. And let's end our 50th edition in some style, because our record of the week is from one of my favourite bands, Los Campesinos. They're great. I followed them ever since I heard them on the Best of MySpace podcast back in 2008. The track is called Hung Empty. It's from their album Six Scenes, which is out now on Wichita Records. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill. We'll see you for season 6 in the autumn. Singing bread of heaven, but they're baking it with our dough. Living as common criminal, but acting local hero. Wish I'd saved with that awkward little silence. Grew up to be a deafening hush. Curling up, cuddling a big red button to push. The students spilling out at the bus stop, forcing me to walk in the street. I move against the tide of the tourists. I am lacking, but they're looking for me. There's plenty of dickheads ever good and every day's a house show.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.